All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck Nicks? What's happening? Anna Gasteyer is here today. I think I should mention that now. She's a former SNL cast member. She's also from Mean Girls, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Broadway shows like Wicked and Funny Girl. She's now on the NBC series American Auto, and I had a nice chat with her. She got me laughing really hard. Some good stories. Good stories about stage performing, about Will Ferrell. It was a nice chat. So last week, I broadcast from my hotel room in Soho, and many people were upset that I did not tell you the hotel. I didn't want to do that while I was still in it. Not that I don't trust you, but you know what I'm saying. But the hotel I was so ecstatic about and so complimentary of was the Crosby Street Hotel on Crosby Street, just below Prince. And that room I had was just stunning. And there are moments like that. Like, I don't always appreciate why people have rooms they don't go into necessarily, but there's an aesthetic thing. You know, that was a suite, and I did sit in all the chairs in there, in both rooms. But I think part of the thing is either it's a practical mindset or just an ignorant mindset that the general aesthetic of your living space, all inclusive, is something that makes your heart feel good. It's something that makes your mind feel good. It's something that you like to rest your eyes on. It's something that makes you feel connected to your environment. And that's one of the small pleasures in life, even if you have a small place. This idea, you know, I've got to get out of this mindset that everything's just to be eaten. Everything's just to be moved through. Everything is just, let's just get to the next moment. Let's just finish up. Let's finish up here. I've got to take some time to appreciate the stuff. And sometimes when you're in a space where everything just comes together, I get this way in art galleries as well, or large gallery spaces like the Whitney or the Tate in London, where the space or the sense of space or the way it's set up or thought out is one of the great kind of uplifting things about being alive, is appreciating space. And I guess that just got reinvigorated. And I like my house and I like my space. I don't like it when it's dirty. And, you know, I have cats and there's a mess all the time. I don't like it when it smells bad. But generally speaking, it's very comfortable to me. And it's also something I engage with when I don't want to think about anything else, which is why I'm thinking about, you know, buying some more shelves, putting more records up. I have this mixed kind of, I go back and forth between, I got to get out of here, time to start packing, let's go, abandon ship. Get off the burning vehicle. Get out. Get out. Pull your ripcord. Box it up. Put it somewhere. It doesn't matter anymore. You can't bring any of this shit with you, man. Fuck all of it. Let somebody come take it away. Between that and, I wonder if I should get a vase, another vase. There's nothing wrong with having a couple of nice vases. Get rid of it all. Burn it down. Give it away out front. I wonder if these window treatments are exactly the way I like them. Should I get some more wall art? Just fucking, you know, run, man. Run. Run far. Run hard. I had a good time in New York, as I told you. I enjoyed my hotel. I did a lot of promotional product for the Bad Guys movie. Got to hang out with Sam Rockwell and... I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing her. Zezzy Bates? She's great. They're all great. It was nice to see everybody. And then I was, I flew home on Thursday night because I had to go to San Diego the next day. And I was going to fly home that Friday morning and just like get home, get in my car and go. But I thought, no, fuck it, dude. Just take that plane out. Take that last flight out at 9:30, left at 10:20. So I get back at like 2 in the morning. I get home. And I, of course, had decided for some reason when we took off at 10:40 New York time that I would just knock back a coffee, not just a coffee, airplane coffee, and watch a couple movies. The movie idea was fine. The coffee idea, not great. But I did watch The French Dispatch, and I think arguably, maybe not even arguably for me, that might be Wes Anderson's best movie. I think it might be his masterpiece. And I wasn't even going to watch it. And I've seen all of them. I think I've seen all of the Wes Anderson movies except for the Zazu one, except for the aquatic one. I'll get on it. No spoilers. But I just thought, you know, the structure of the French Dispatch, the way he paid homage to all these different styles, European television, you know, European hipster movies, magazine, writing, all of it, period pieces, stories. It all worked. It all came together. It was stunning, meticulous, as always, but just really a fucking masterpiece. That's my review of the French Dispatch. And everybody was awesome in it. Jeffrey Wright, wow. Wow. What a fucking performance. Benicio was good. That girl was good. I don't know her name. I know her from another movie. Is she French? That's where my movie reviewing skills kind of taper off when I don't know cast members' names. I also watched Spencer, which, to be honest with you, is a poetic meditation on the condition of Lady Di's life at a particular point in time when things were starting to break apart a bit. Not unlike that guy's other movie, Jackie. It was about grief, struggle, trauma, isolation. I thought it was great. And I thought she was great in it. Kristen Stewart, Tour de Force. So anyways, I watch those two movies. I get home at 2:30 in the morning and I'm like, I'm going to go to bed now. But my cat's very excited. And fucking Smushy, Sammy Red, just kept jumping on the bed, jumping on my head, fucking around with things, kept waking me up. I had to put it. It's just so awful when I can't sleep. When you've had a history of cocaine use in your life, and even though it's 22 years behind me, when you can't get to sleep and the sun's about to poke through your fucking curtains, it's triggering, man. Very triggering. But I kept it together, put some earplugs in, slept on and off maybe 2-3 hours total. Not great. Had to get up, stock up the fridge, and then drive to San Diego, which in my experience is a fucking shit show. Every time I've gone there, my GPS says 2.5 hours maybe, and I'm on the road for over 4 hours. Esther Pavitsky comes over. She's opening for me. We get in the car. Thank God she was, you know, I wasn't going crazy because I had experienced before. We got on the road at 2 and we had a sound check at 6 and we just made it. Couldn't even check into the hotel. And I was exhausted because I'm on 3 hours sleep. So now I'm punchy and weird and loopy going into these two shows. And I haven't done the hour, you know, in months, not since New York. And Esther was great. Great opener for me. Just low key, killed, did well, set a tone that didn't, you know, make everything crazy. And it was just smooth. And I was able to kind of lean into it, lay back a bit and unfold the bits and pieces that I had put together before, and they were almost all new for me because I hadn't done it in a few months. And for some reason, the venue has a pretty solid hour limit or a curfew in a way for both shows because they have to close the place down by a certain time. So I had to do just an hour each show, which was a great exercise for me because you let me, I'll ramble on for an hour and a half, hour 45, even if I'm not doing well. But the hour kind of got me locked into like, well, this is the job now. Put the special together, man. Put it together. It looks like we're going to close a deal for a special. I'll tell you where when that's done. And I don't know when it's going to film. But all my tour dates are at WTFpod.com/tour. Got a couple of chunks. I'll try to bring Esther with me as much as possible. Kevin Christie will be with me up in San Francisco and Napa. And again, those COVID rules at the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco are everyone needs to be vaxxed and boostered to get in. And I didn't know this, and I hope it doesn't inconvenience everybody in terms of like having to have the booster. But that's what Maz Jobrani told me. He was just there the last weekend, and he said, heads up. So I'm giving you the heads up. But again, thank you, San Diego. And the drive back was not terrible. 2 hours. It was nicer. I was still kind of tired. All right. Here we go. Anna Gasteyer is here, and I didn't know what to expect, but I got some deep laughs in the middle of the thing, and she's great to talk to, and I really enjoyed it. She's now on the NBC series American Auto, which has new episodes Tuesday nights, all right? I'm going to talk to her right now. Here we go. Phil Gasteyer in Corrales, New Mexico?
Yep. former two-time mayor.
So, but they've been there for a while, and he's a mayor twice.
Yeah. So
just, is that a hobby for him, being a mayor?
No, so he, yeah, so I grew up in, my parents are Midwestern people
yeah.
who came to the big city to work in big government in D.C. So I grew up in D.C.
In the big government, the big one.
In the big one.
Yeah, so he went from.
The one that's failing now.
Right, he went, yeah, the one that's barely hanging
the
on.
The crumbling one.
Yeah. What did he do in big government?
He did a few things. He started out as he worked in Senator Al Ullman from Oregon's office.
Yeah,
he worked in campaign, and then he worked on the lobbying side because he was a lawyer. So he worked. Of course, you could say lobby back then. Nobody would be like Adam McKay's mob wouldn't come after you,
right? That, it wasn't associated with horrible things,
right?
Yeah,
I mean it was probably, but yeah. Anyway. For whatever, it would seem like a justified.
It wasn't associated with using the government as a money laundering operation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So first he worked for, it's two nefarious things if you mention them sort of in a row. One was the, I really think it might have been the corn syrup manufacturers.
Oh, really? Because they did what, they lied about something?
Well, no, I mean, just when in terms of nutritional hindsight, the conversation is that the farm subsidies were influenced by the idea that we needed to find different uses for corn.
Oh, right, right.
And so we came up with corn syrup,
and then gas, and then ethanol.
High fructose corn syrup, which we then dumped into
everything,
and now we're just a bunch of
diabetic
fatsoes. Yeah. And then he worked for savings and loans, and then the savings and loans imploded.
Yeah, that was a big deal. I remember reading about it in the newspaper.
Yeah, it was a big deal. But my parent, you know, he's a very kind of moral, ethical Democrat.
Yeah.
I mean, they're lefty.
Yeah. They're together?
They're still together. They've been married 62 years.
Wow.
Yeah, they're very happily married. I'd be super lucky that way.
And they're just hanging out in Corrales.
And so, yeah, so they moved. We owned, the point I would say about my dad and the savings and the loans, we own the movie, and my parents are, they're mildly into pop culture, but nothing like other people. We own the movie It's a Wonderful Life growing up, not because of the magical tale of wistful recognition of things you might have not appreciated, but because it's the best representation of savings and loans in American cinema. Because of that scene when the building and loan goes under, when the stock market crashes, and then George has to explain that he can't give the money back because the money's in so-and-so's house, and the money's in, that's how a building and loan works. So my dad loved that because it represented the best of the sort of savings and loan as a micro-lending institution, basically. Yeah.
So he watched it regularly.
So we would watch it every year. Yeah, just mostly for that scene. Anyway, so the savings and loans fell on their face, and it was a real bummer. If you believed in the good part of them. And then so my dad was general counsel for the U.S. Savings and Loan League, and he sort of saw the writing on the wall that savings and loans were going to be a thing of yore.
Yeah.
And retired at 59. And my mom had already moved out to Corrales. She was an art teacher, but she's an artist. She's a ceramic artist, really full time.
She have a studio over there?
Oh, yeah. And a million kilns and a million.
Really?
Yeah. A lot of mosaics.
She does tiles too?
No. She does that from the stuff that is broken. But she's an incredible watercolor artist.
Oh,
so a lot of her work,
she does sculpture,
but she does pots and she does
bowls.
Pots. And I'll send you some Mariana Gasteyer.
Really?
Yeah.
Is she famous?
I mean, to me.
Yeah.
But it was pretty cool because she just was like, she took a sabbatical and was like, had been teaching for 25 years or something. Uh-huh. They had driven through Albuquerque and stayed with distant cousins.
Right.
And had made this comment like to themselves in the early 20s. Like, oh, we want to retire in Albuquerque. I have no idea why.
Wild. I kind of want to go back there.
Yeah. So my mom then was like, I'm going to go do art in Albuquerque. I don't know why.
It's beautiful sky there. It's very inspirational. Yeah. A lot of art comes from there, especially those earthy arts.
A lot of the earthy arts come from there. The earnest arts.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, the earnest arts.
And
it is really an American melting pot, multi-culti vibe there, which I really like. Like, there's such a sort of distinctive relationship with Native American roots,
with the Latino culture,
with the Hispanic American culture. Yeah. Like, it's really cool.
So they've been out there that long. So you kind of did, but you never really grew up there, but you've been going there forever.
I've been going there since I was an adult. Like, they moved there right after I finished college. So their whole third act has been there. But so my dad served on, he was the planning and zoning commissioner, which is a big deal in a small town because it's all these things, these variances of who lets people build things, can you do it?
And it's a manageable job in a town that size. So it was.
Yeah, they're about 8,500.
Yeah.
And he has the legal background, so he could like read the fine print and understand what he's talking. And he loved it. And then he was on the city council, and then they asked him to run for mayor. And then he was 2-time mayor.
Yeah.
And then he did one more term at council after.
And now he's just.
And now he's now he's in two book clubs.
That's it. I just remember like I had two friends down there, and their parents were like old hippies and, and weirdos, and. At those houses, I kind of have this vague memory of these hippie houses down there.
You would like my mom's house.
It's very specific, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it's terrifying. I'll say this into the microphone, knowing my father's listening. It's terrifying thinking of two people in their early 80s with a wobbly brick floor and adobe walls.
Yeah.
And like, I mean,
they got one of those good ones.
They're one wipeout away each, you know?
But it holds up there. It's not, there's no earthquakes yet, and there's like no massive.
No, but they, I don't know if they're going to hold up. Like, there's no, when I try to explain it to people, and I'm glad you understand it, they don't have a driveway.
Right.
They have like.
Yeah.
Like, if one of them needs a walker, it is the most... You can't roll a bag from the car to the front door.
Right.
You know? And they converted their garage into my mom's studio.
Sure.
So even if you want to go through, you have to... It's like a landmine of pottery and clay and dust and kilns.
Well, that's, I guess that's when they'll make the renovations, when the walkers come. Then they'll finally...
They put in grab bars. My dad's like, we've got grab bars. Yeah, it's fine.
That's hilarious.
And they did get a big TV. We talked them into a big TV.
Like
because
big
they
screen,
do
like the
big ass.
Yeah.
Well, not as big as like LA, but like it was like 55
inches. That's big. Yeah.
They were pretty excited.
They're pretty daunting TVs.
They are.
It was a big adjustment for me even to get my first big one. You're like, holy shit.
But you know those smart ones, especially for the olds?
Yeah.
They're great.
Yeah.
Because you just click to the home and you find the thing. And my parents are pretty ahead of it in terms of knowing they're like,
that's good.
What is Netflix and what is.
Yeah. My dad's still there. He's still in New Mexico. He lives up by the mountain.
Oh my God. Is he a hippie too?
No. He's a sort of a retired in shame surgeon who's like slowly losing it.
Happens.
Yeah, it does. But your parents sound like they got it together.
Well, they have each other.
Yeah. Well, he's got a wife, but like, I don't know. It's like when it's scary. Old is scary.
I know. We could talk about this for hours. It's kind of all I talk about. Just because I'm at a point in my life where, you know, I have a child that just left for college.
Right.
And I have parents that I live really far away from.
Right.
I hate that I live really far from them. And I was raised, we were raised, so I think it was like such an American way to like grow up and leave where you grew up.
Yeah.
You know, like the dream is that your children will leave.
Right. But you grew up in D.C. So
D.C.
You live in New York now or around there?
I live in New York. In Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And they're there. But like, what are you obsessing about age? Because I'm not freaking out too bad.
I'm not obsessing about my own age, but I am wanting, I'm looking around and I'm seeing, I mean, so many of my friends are in situations with parents that have crisis that they're suddenly dealing with that they don't know how to deal with and navigate. And I think the only answer is, well, my husband's family did it so obnoxiously effectively.
Really? With his folks?
Yeah, like his dad just like, took it upon, he had a bunch of pre-death meetings. He's very organized.
pre-death
there
meetings.
Was a binder. There was like a death binder.
Really?
And my husband and his sister would go there down to, he grew up in D.C. too.
Like,
go down, once a month or something.
Right.
And all the paper, his obit is written.
Wow.
His headstone is carved.
I don't even know if I have a plot.
I don't either. Yeah.
I don't know where my dad's is either.
Everything's super organized. And he's like, But here's the thing, and this is my pitch for myself and for you. He moved into a place.
The old man. His old man.
Yeah. At 85.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yeah.
But he downsized from a 7-bedroom house to a, 1,000-square-foot apartment with white carpeting. They all have carpeting because of the aforementioned wipeouts.
Yeah.
And
that's why they have it.
I keep telling my parents, and they don't care, is what was so beautiful about it is in the planning of it, we got to go through the house, break down the house, get rid of everything.
With him.
In the absence of grief.
Yeah.
So you could look at these collections of like,
oh, that's a good
idea. Like, wow, that was a fun time.
Yeah.
We don't need all these books, whatever. Like, we don't need the Bierstein collection anymore.
And he was like, okay.
No, I mean, he felt that. He was like, I did that part. And I'm now ready to move on. Like, there were wedding, like, he's divorced, we were like, things from their wedding that he's like, I'm not going to throw for 40 years, for 40 anymore. Like, it's just, I'm not going to do that. I'm 85 years old.
I look at my stuff like that now.
Yeah.
Like, what am I doing with these books still?
I know. He has the largest collection of books in North America on the Spanish Civil War, which there's like, there were.
Do you take those to the apartment?
It's just those
and
a teeny little bedroll. And a hot plate. And he's happy.
Why wouldn't he be?
No, I think he gave him to his alma mater. But
it's devastating.
Yeah, so, but I have watched him thrive in the most beautiful way, because what I watch, and then my parents, again, don't believe me about this, because they don't want, my mom's so averse to the idea of moving somewhere organized around her age.
Yeah.
But what I see in him is that the absence of stress. I see him not worrying about
the plumbing,
and oh, that tree is hanging really low. I should call someone to have them bring. Should I do things like all of the like? Oh, you know, I've got to do something because it gets so icy on the steps every year, and blah 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 blah. Whatever it is, you know.
I think that's probably why a lot of older people hurt themselves. Because they don't do those things, and eventually the reason they have to move is they've broken everything because they fell down.
That's what I'm saying.
I know.
I told my mom, I'm like, you're not going to move, you're not going to do anything, and then you're going to have a fall, and then that's it.
Yeah.
That's why so many people are eventually, that's but the last thing that happens.
It also sounds like this guy's got a pretty good mindset around the death thing.
He's so insanely practical. He's like, you know,
be practical about it, because it's like it's inevitable. You should be able to wrap your brain around it, but it's hard.
It's very hard.
It's the worst.
Yeah.
I mean,
No, it's impossible. It's impossible. But he's very much like, I mean, aggravatingly like, well, you quit smoking, you put a rubber band around your wrist and you snap it every time that you have a craving. What's the problem?
The problem is you don't know me. And that's not going to
do it. What about the crying? What do I do about the crying?
And what do I replace it with?
What else can I shove in my mouth?
Yeah, exactly. That is the big question on a day-to-day.
That really is the question. What else can I shove in my mouth?
I just went to New York for 2 days, and I'm like, I feel disgusting
from eating.
Well, yeah, because I was managing the weight, and I was like, I wanted to lose a few. I like to be at a certain weight, and I finally got there. But as soon as I got to New York for like 2 days, it was like I'd never eaten
the
before.
Bacchanal. Yeah,
it was just like I couldn't stop.
I know. That happened. I always compare myself. I always thought I was female and hormonal, but it's like a bear breaking into a camper.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Just
and it
a
felt
violent,
so good.
Ripping shit out of the cabinets. Like, I don't care.
Yeah, just eat it.
Eat it.
And I feel the shame while it's going in. Like, I'm enjoying it for maybe a second. It's simultaneous.
Yeah, it's ruined by shame.
I'm like, this is amazingly, I'm terrible.
But so I always have the logic in a place like New York where I would be like, well, I'm walking it off.
Yeah.
It didn't work?
No, yeah, but you're not really. I mean, I exercise. I know what is going to lose weight.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the 6 blocks with the 2 slices of pizza, not going to do it.
Yeah, but weren't they good? They were good.
They were good. Where do you get pizza?
Well, I live in Pizza Central.
But like Joe's, do you go to Joe's anymore? Like,
yeah,
like
it's funny.
Carmine?
It's so funny that you said that, because I had I was doing something in the city. Oh, I had a gig.
Yeah.
And
singing?
Singing. I wrote a Christmas album that
I know. Listen to some of it.
Sugar and Booze.
Yeah.
So speaking of putting things in your mouth.
Yeah.
I did shows this Christmas, and my 13-year-old, who is literally growing an inch and a half every day, he's almost 5'11", and he's 13. He's just like keeps growing. He's a little beanpole, and he was so hungry. And my husband was like, "I'm taking him to Joe's
on Carmine, 6."
Yes,
old school, the best.
NYU,
Was music always the thing?
I'm such a weird. Well, it's starting to make more sense. I started as a musician, no doubt.
When was this?
I mean, the thing that I...
When you were a kid?
The thing I do well first was to sing.
When you were like, what, high school?
Yeah, middle school.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I do have an older brother.
But he's not in show business.
No, he's a professor.
Of what?
Sociology.
Oh, nice.
It's a good balance.
Oh, sociology is a good one. It's like no math.
He teaches at MSU, so he has like all of the basketball players.
Interesting.
Yeah, he's awesome. I love him.
I like the whole idea. I just got a letter from a sociologist who said that he was using bits and pieces of my podcast.
I believe it.
In his classes, and he wanted to know if I had time. Maybe I'd talk to him about something. I don't remember. I got to look it up.
Yeah, you should do that. That'd be nice.
Is it?
Yeah. He's an agricultural sociologist, so he teaches at MSU, which is a farm school, really. Like
agricultural sociology?
Because his thing was he went to the Peace Corps, and he lived in West Africa for a long time. Then he lived in the Middle East, and his work is with basically water access in communities.
Okay, so
as a result, when he went into the study of sociology, it had to do with how groups align themselves around farming and water.
That's interesting, I guess.
I mean, I'm making a very general, it's more specific than
I'm
that.
I'm sure
but
it
could
be more specific, but I'm kind of grasping it.
They're really helping the world. He and my sister-in-law, she's a law professor and
they're taking care of it?
She is, yeah. She's okay. She's basically changing, literally her research is changing the conversation about jury selection and as race, impacted by race in the death penalty.
Oh, really?
They're amazing. So I just make fart noises and ask if this is a good sound on my kazoo. I keep it light.
But your heart's in the right place.
I don't know. Is it?
I don't know.
It's very selfish.
That's it, though, isn't it? But you think, you want to think that you're doing things. I've been doing a joke on stage about just we all know that the climate is, like, we know it. Mm-hmm. And none of us are taking any sort of real position.
Isn't that the don't look up premise?
Well, kind of. But in the back of your head, you're sort of like, well, that Swedish teenager thing, she has it under
control.
She'll
get it.
Yeah,
she'll
exactly.
Do it.
Greta's got it.
Yeah, that Parkland kid will deal with the guns.
There's nothing I can do that she's not doing.
That's how I feel about the gun kid. Yeah.
I don't want to get in her way.
No, she's busy. She's got stuff to do. I mean, the worst part for comedians, too, is like, I guess I'll host your benefit. And then you're like, really? That's how you're going to contribute? And I have friends that are like, and then you bitch about that, by the way. You agree to do it, and then you're like,
oh, fuck.
Fuck, I have to do this benefit.
They're going
to
be eating.
I know. So awful. And I have had the thought, you're like, God, I wish I was so rich I could just write this check.
Yeah, I don't know. I do give to charity.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have specific ones I give to. And one of them is the...
Are they all feline?
One of them is.
Yeah.
One of them is the Carolina Tiger Rescue.
You bet.
They rescue big cats, and they just take care of them.
I think that's awesome.
From roadside attractions or idiots who buy tigers. Because you can just buy...
I bet there are so many of those people in this country. I swear to God. You know, because before the red state, blue state thing really happened.
They don't think ahead. They're just it's cute now.
There's tons of that. There's tons of snakes like that, too. Yeah. Because before it was actually people who were storming the Capitol and not.
Yeah.
Before we were
in people who owned
Democrats.
Tigers.
We used to watch that show, Doomsday Preppers, because it was awesome.
Yeah.
But it was incredible. We had like a running tally of the number of people on Doomsday Preppers who sustained their habit through exotic animal breeding.
Huh.
It was an amazing percentage of those people who like had a basement full of iguanas.
Do you know what I think about that?
For the aftertimes.
Have you ever thought like, who the fuck wants to live? These people are like, we got to survive. It's like, I don't want to be around. I don't want to be part of the post-apocalyptic thing.
Well, this is the problem with The Walking Dead. It really illustrated a lot of that to us.
You mean we're never going to be able to avoid it because we're going to come back as zombies?
No. Meaning it just, it took me an embarrassing number of episodes before I was like, oh, it's the people. That's who we have to be afraid of.
Our neighbor.
But I went to, I was on tour with Sugar and Booze with my Christmas record.
Yeah.
And
what, do you bring a combo? You bring a little orchestra? How many people?
I do 5 on the road, and we're at 8 in New York, in LA.
What's that like?
So I can have a proper horn section. I have a really big singing voice.
Yeah.
Meaning, I don't know if it's good or bad, but it's big.
Would you consider it cabaret?
Not Sugar and Booze. I mean, it's throwbacky.
Yeah, right.
But the thing I like about the Christmas like thing is it sort of answered a problem that I was trying to solve. So to go back to answer your question. About music.
Yeah.
The first thing I did that I knew I could do that other people couldn't do well was sing. And not in a way of like I thought, oh, I'm so special or anything like that. It was just like I would imagine if like you're an athlete or something.
Yeah, you got a knack for it. You're
somebody's
natural.
Like, hey, you got, and I remember the moments of like teachers and things like in class presentations.
You got it, kid.
Yeah, just being like, give her the solo, and registering like, oh, that's weird. Okay.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I loved it and I did it more and more and more. And I acted too and stuff in high school, but I didn't, it's weird. My parents are very, they're very cool.
Yeah.
But I was not, I did not grow up in a world where you could, like, I didn't think that I could go do that for a living.
Be an entertainer?
Yeah. certainly not that level, especially those words, like then reconciling. Everything you did had to be a little bit smart and a little bit academic.
Right.
And my parents are like opera buffs. They're cooler now. Like they watch
opera buffs.
Big opera buffs.
So real hoity-toities?
Yeah. So like my first professional job was in the children's chorus of La Boheme at Washington Opera. And then I played the child ghost in Macbeth, Verdi's Macbeth, at the Washington Opera. And I was in like 19.
Big. It's a big room, right?
The Kennedy Center Opera House.
It's the Kennedy Center.
It was an opera house, yeah.
It's amazing.
It was massive.
It's so exciting when you're a kid and you're like the stage. Like I still think about it. Like I was just in San Diego at a little theater last night. That moment that one enters a stage is so wild.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
I know. I did Wicked, the show.
Did you do it like in like when it was being put together?
I did Wicked in Chicago.
Okay, right.
Well,
It
was the beginning. It was a third company.
Oh.
So I auditioned for Elphaba the beginning.
Yeah.
But it was right after 9/11. And I was still about to do Saturday Night, my sixth season.
Yeah.
And I was pregnant and I hadn't told anybody. So it was like not a great time to be preparing a giant belting number. Also, to be totally frank, I didn't know how to navigate that kind of singing yet. Because what I did was
musical?
Musical. Because I'd just been doing comedy singing at that point. It was the sit down production in Chicago. So Chicago had never had its own original production in the Broadway world of a musical.
Yeah.
They since have had Hamilton and a couple other, but that's it. So usually just tour shows, like coming through and leaving. So it was really cool because it was like a proper production.
Yeah.
And we did it for a very long time. And then I went and did it on Broadway. Anyway, I had done 1 million performances.
Yeah.
And all you think about when you are singing like that every day is sleep.
Right.
Because it's the only thing, like it's just the most instrumental piece of getting your voice where it needs to be in the morning.
And healthy.
Yeah. So at one point, the doctor gave me Ambien, which I can't believe is legal. I literally can't. There's no time at which you bring up Ambien with anyone that they don't have the most horrifying story you've ever heard. Like right up their
going shopping
like,
naked.
Yeah, literally somebody said, oh, my business manager murdered her husband on Ambien. Like literally just people like drop that kind of thing as though it's casually.
Yeah.
And you're like, why? How is this legal? I don't understand. Like the COVID vaccine took that long to clear and everyone still takes Ambien. Anyway, I took Ambien.
Yeah.
And it does knock you out.
Yeah.
Shopping naked. Eight hours of sleep, whatever. And I started to drop out. Like, my brain was losing lines. They would come back.
Yeah.
But I ran on stage, my 955th performance. And the thing about Wicked is like, so she's an outsider when she first enters, and it's all these kids at Shiz University, and they're on the other side of stage, supposed to be, and they're all staring at me, and it was like an hour. It was just an hour where I fell down into the well with baby Jessica. Yeah, I was down. I couldn't. It was like, it was slow motion, like when you can feel your neural pathways going like. It was like that.
Yeah.
And I remember staring at them and them looking at me like enough of a, you know, the beat passes.
Yeah.
And then the adrenaline, the sweat, the cortisol, the hot flush.
Yeah.
Thank God I was green.
Yeah.
And then another beat. And then the registering beat when they look at you and they're like, what the fuck is going on? And then I said the line.
Yeah.
And then felt the relief. They replied. And then I couldn't remember the next line.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Oh, no.
I did it, ultimately, but it was one of those, it's hard to explain.
Did anyone have to sort of, like, do that weird thing where they feed you the, maybe you should.
No.
Oh, good.
They couldn't have, because they were people who weren't, you know, because you go to that place in your mind where you're like, how do I justify this in character, which is also so weird about theater. I was on stage once with an actor, a famous actor who had a stroke.
Oh. Yeah, what, is that a secret?
It's not a secret.
Oh.
It was Tony Roberts, actually.
Yeah.
And it was a play.
Is he still around?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
He was fantastic. But it was the most incredible thing to watch the experience of people continuing to behave like assholes in character.
Right.
Like behind the fake fourth wall.
Did he go down?
No.
Oh.
He entered and he spoke like a broken, it sounded like a record going backwards.
Yeah.
But he still was delivering lines in comedic cadence, and the audience was laughing.
It was gibberish?
Gibberish. And he got three or four lines out where the audience was like, that was a rhythmic joke.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? He was like, how does that end?
And then it started to go to like,
and well, then we also, and then John Glover, who was on stage with me, went hustling over in character. That's the other part. You're just like, and we all maintain character. Like, that's when you look back and you're like, theater's insane. It's like a bunch of people dressed up in like period costume and hats and man having a stroke.
And all
of
you
are like, well, I think we have a little problem here. I'll just see you to your quarters. You know, like whatever, trying to like help one another. And then meanwhile, and then the curtain goes down.
What did Glover do?
He went and took his arm because he... That's what it registered for me. It was like, oh, his blocking is off. Like, he's going... But he was acting... He was such a pro that he was acting through his stroke. It was insane. And then the curtain came down, and then it was like, is there a doctor in the house kind of thing? And then absolutely everybody fulfilled their... Like, showed why they were cast.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the... You know, like the ingenue started crying right away, the old diva. It was this play called The Royal Family, which was written about the Barrymores. It was a parody that Kaufman wrote.
And yeah,
literally, the old diva was like, "I'm feeling a little peaked." You know, it was just there. Everybody was having like their moment. It was amazing.
That was the show backstage.
Mm-hmm. It was incredible. Oh, and then he was back on. He was back on stage within like a week and a half.
Oh, so it wasn't a big
one. No. It was good. It was good.
It's so funny because when you think back on it, the stakes are not that high. Like, in a sense...
That's what I'm saying.
You could just be like, can we stop the show?
It's like, sorry, guys.
Yeah, like the half a house of
I
old
people.
I forgot
my lines.
Why not?
I know it was only $350.
Oh, well, that's a bit much. Yeah, I guess that would mean... Yeah, you got to struggle it out.
Here's my other weird showbiz story. This isn't even... Like, but I did another musical on Broadway, this show... of the Threepenny Opera, which everyone's done in college and high school. So everybody...
I don't even know it. I had to ask Tony Kushner the other day to explain to me what Brechtian was.
Well, it's a bummer. It's really, in my opinion, should just be studied and not done.
Uh-huh.
But that's a very...
Yeah.
Now I'm going to get canceled.
Yeah, by Tony Kushner.
Those Brecht Tony people Kushner. Are going to come for my ass.
The Brechtians are brutal.
No, they're rough. They used to be a little...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Loose. You're never going to be able to do off Broadway again. Or college production.
Yeah, ever. I will be asked to leave. Yeah. We're going to ask you to leave. I'm going to have to ask you to leave. Anyway, so we did this Brechtian, we did this production, and it was like, you know, it just was a misfire. Like, they were trying to be sort of edgy on Broadway, which is always a tricky thing because people are paying so much
money.
That's
always the one they do, though, isn't it? Threepenny Opera? Isn't
always.
That, yeah,
because everybody did it in college.
And there's music in that, right?
Yeah, it's Kurt Vile. It's like the peak snob factor.
Mac the Knife is in it.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So, and it's brilliant. Again, though, I think I would rather read it. Or listen.
Yeah, or study it.
Or study it. Yeah.
This is why this man was important to many a long time ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the whole, I'm sure, well, as your good friend Tony Kushner explained, like the breaking of the wall and sort of all of the like the aggression and that it was so much of it was about things that we're worried about now, right? It was about
fascism.
Fascism. Yeah. But the director was not really interested on that side of it. He didn't really want to focus on that. And so. It was just a very sort of aggressively fancy downtown, uptown production, which kind of was a misfire. Uh-huh. They were like drag queens and, you know, whatever, things that people are like, that's quote-unquote edgy. And that's fine. Whatever. He was trying his own vision.
Sure.
But they did this thing with, I have a giant voice, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
It's just loud. And they amplified everybody in this kind of caustic way.
Is that part of the art?
It's part of the art.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And it was kind of abrasive. And Ben Brantley said something kind of like, Anna Gasteyer sings with the sound of 1,000 trumpets. It's like something, not sure if it was a compliment, you know, like.
Yeah, that's what critics do.
Yeah.
I think that's good.
Is that good? Trumpets are, people like trumpets.
Yeah, a lot of trumpets.
They announce stuff. So just like debilitating conundrum.
They're like, no, I think it is good. I think that, how could that be bad?
Except for my dad, who was like, you are loud. So anyway, the like week we were about to close, and it definitely was one of those shows that just didn't, for me, was not a happy, fun experience. Like the closing notice goes up and people are crying and stuff. And the whole time I'm like, yes, like by myself in my room. And I don't, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It was fine. I'm grateful it's on my resume. I learned a lot about music.
Brecht and that.
Yeah. And the vocal was actually amazing. But the sound system went down.
Uh-huh.
The like four performances before the end. And this is going to make you feel really smart.
Yeah.
The sound system went down and there was a long wait. It was like 12 minutes with the curtain. And then finally the announcement came up saying, ladies and gentlemen, the sound system has gone down. You can stay and see the show without amplification.
Yeah.
Which in the year, whatever that was, is sort of unheard of. Everything on Broadway is hyper-mic'd.
Yeah.
Everybody's like fed through the mixer. And they're like, they said, you'll have the opportunity to hear a song, hear these songs without amplification.
Like, they were written.
Yeah, and Studio 54, which is a former opera house, like, it was kind of amazing. And the audience went crazy. They had, like, 12 people left and got their money back. They're like, you can have your money back if you want. Anyway, it ended up being, first of all, just a mind-blowingly fantastic performance because it was stripped so much of the artifice of fake sound.
Yeah.
We had to, like, stand off stage and like do crash boxes and crowd noises.
Oh, wow.
And because all the sound effects were out.
That's
too
great.
And then even things like, you know, the announcements for you come for the stage, like it's your entrance from the stage manager. Like if you're up on the third floor, we all had to be really present. And it ended up being so accidentally Brechtian, where everybody was so aware of the architecture of the theater of it.
Yeah.
That it was like the one of the best nights in the theater.
Wow.
That I've had. It was wild.
That's great. Why wasn't Ben Brantley at that one?
Well, and he would have found that I also sing like a trumpeter without amplification. Yeah.
Not 1,000 though, just 500.
Yeah, exactly.
So what, going back to the music, so when you graduated what, college?
So I went to Northwestern as a voice major. I got in as a singer.
Were you doing comedy too?
So I got in as a voice major, earnest, the most earnest bunch of humans you've ever met in your life.
I can't imagine.
It was stultifying. And there was a moment where there was a man who came in to teach overtones in an ethnomusicology class. It's not funny. I don't know why.
I don't even know what it means.
Anyway, an overtone is a thing that's when you hit one note and another note resonates above it.
Okay.
So this man had studied overtones in Tibet and he just started
chanting.
Like out of nowhere, and he didn't have like a discursive style, so he just would in the middle of the speech, and I became unglued, and I was asked to leave the lecture. And that's when I realized I shouldn't be a music major. These are not my people. So
you could stop laughing.
I could not stop laughing. I had like a church laughing attack. Because this guy was like, in the middle of, it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen in my life. So I was in school in Chicago, and obviously improv is big there. And I joined the improv group, and I was like, aha, I just found my people.
Yeah.
And so I ended up just getting a regular old theater degree, and a bossy friend told me to move to L.A.
Yeah.
And then Kathy Griffin told me to do the Groundlings.
Yeah.
My life is a series of bossy
responses. Yeah, people yelling at you.
She literally was like, why aren't you doing the Groundlings? I don't know what. So I did it. We met at an audition. Like,
yeah.
And we just spent the day together. I really liked her. And so she was like, go do the Groundlings. And so I did the Groundlings.
Did she go all the way through the Groundlings?
Yeah, she was Groundlings forever. Taught there forever. And then
I
would sing. Like, I would sing in bits and stuff. But I didn't really, you know, I didn't think I was a singer anymore. I smoked a pack a half a day and all that.
But you were having fun.
I was having a great time.
And it was like, I've never been to a Groundling show.
What?
I know.
Why? Are you too cool?
No, I don't go out much. But I mean, they sound hilarious and amazing.
Oh my God. I have such a fondness for that place. And I have a fondness for it because it is not cool. It has never been cool.
Yeah.
And because I was going to do the Second City and I went and there were like two women in the company. They seem kind of overshadowed. Remember, it was the 90s, early 90s when I graduated college, 89.
Yeah.
And the Groundlings was just like wigs and glasses at a good time. Like, when I first went to a show, there was Jennifer Coolidge, Lisa Kudrow, Mindy Sterling, Heather Morgan. Like, these hilarious.
Heather Morgan, I wonder what she's up to.
Hilarious women.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, I want to do this thing.
Yeah.
Kathy Griffin. Just big, loud, funny girls. Karen Mariama. And so I did it. And I remember the Northwestern crew, like the improv people.
Yeah.
They were like,
right.
We don't really want to do the Groundlings.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not my thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they were like too cool. And then, so I did.
Well, that whole Chicago improv scene is rooted in a certain hipness, right?
Oh,
that whole,
God,
what, Del Close and all that
shit.
Yes,
it's so cool. Yeah. It's also, and I tried desperately, but it didn't,
Did your time doing Heralds?
Exactly. And so again, I did two levels of the Groundlings, yeah. and then I did like a, the people who are teaching there have to come vote on you like, yeah. to move you up. And again, Kathy Griffin, she called me up and she was like, I don't understand. Why aren't you wearing wigs and glasses? It's the Groundlings.
Why aren't you?
Yeah, because I thought I was being cool.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
she was
yeah.
like, do it or don't. And I remember being so grateful for that. I was like, if it's not cool, like fucking lean in. It's yeah. fun. Who yeah. cares? It's fine.
Wigs and
it's
glasses.
It's loud and uncool.
Yeah.
So I did that. Yeah. And
And that was it? The big breakthrough?
That was it. And then I moved to, then I got SNL.
Because that's what Lauren says. How do you feel about wigs? Like, he's asked men that. I've known two men I've interviewed.
Really?
Where he's asked them about wigs.
It's funny because he has really strong opinions about wigs. Like, his eye for wig detail
yeah.
is excellent.
It is.
Where he'll be, and funnily enough, like, there's, I love SNL.
Yeah.
My favorite thing about SNL, like, I look back on it, is there's so much righteous indignation there in costume.
Yeah.
So there's always somebody, like, crying in a polar bear outfit or, like, you know what I mean? There's so much, like, ridiculous. And I remember Will, when we did these middle school music teachers that sang together, and Will Ferrell, we wrote with Paul Appel,
yeah.
and we decided very early on in the writing that he had a bald pate and a full wig, I mean a full beard and mustache,
yeah.
but that he was fully bald but with full facial frontal right. facial hair. And Lauren didn't like it. Like, he yeah. just had an opinion about it.
Yeah.
And I just remember the furious moment where Will was like, I'm going to take a stand. I'm going to take a stand. But like with the spirit gum and it's like, his mouth kind of stuck, you know, and like storming the castle dressed as like a middle school music teacher.
In a bald wig?
Yeah, in a bald wig. So funny.
Did he win?
We won, yeah. We won. Yeah. We took a stand.
So what was your process of getting SNL? It was just like they were casting and you...
Will recommended me. I didn't know him. He was like ahead of me at the ground.
Farrell?
Yeah, but we had done a Thursday show maybe together or something.
How is he so fucking funny?
He's so fucking funny.
I don't even know.
He's the funniest person ever. And then...
And he's so on purpose with it. Like, he can turn it on and off so quickly.
100%. And also just a guru... Yeah. He was then, and he yeah. continues to be, of, he's not spent a whole lot of time sweating his process. Like, sweating I mean, he was one of the first, and it paid out so beautifully for him at the show.
It's such a natural thing.
Like, he's so comfortable selling. He's so comfortable failing. He's really comfortable. That sounds like so processed.
He's got to be great failing.
He's so comfortable failing. But he, you know, this is a story I've told before,
yeah.
and it's really not mine to tell, but I just find that it's
But I like that you've done it many times.
Well, I mean, I've...
Do you preface it that way every time?
I don't think I've said it in... that, the Tony Roberts story on this, or I've not said on a podcast, meaning I tell them at dinner parties.
Yeah.
Maybe, but...
it's nice that you have friends.
But I try. the thing... I think about this a lot
yeah.
as a parent, and I probably fail at it. And as a person, as yeah. I try to learn to wear more wigs and glasses, kind of lean onto that side of things.
Right,
it's important.
Because
I did come from Smarty Pants Town. So even... I had an interview on NPR this week, and you catch myself like trying to sound.
Oh yeah, you're doing the thing.
Ugh, yeah. No, just like the, it was such a. My childhood was one of real academics and intellectuals,
yeah.
so I always have this pressure, but I'm not really like that. So it's this combination.
But creative people, right? I mean, you did come from supportive, creative people.
Yeah, creative yeah. people.
Your mom does the pots and the paintings.
The pots and the
yeah.
Yeah, that's true. My dad's super funny, like
so,
in real life.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is a really interesting thing to me
yeah.
about Will, and this sort
okay.
of explains everything to me. Kay Farrell, his mom, one time told me that in middle school,
yeah,
Will had qualified for the Gifted and Talented After School Enrichment Program.
Yeah,
and she signed him up.
Yeah,
these are kids gifted and talented, and the scheduling came in, and she was looking at it, and they suddenly realized that there had been a bump where Will had proactively signed himself up for square dancing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And he was really actively bummed that he would have to go to this gifted and talented thing after school instead of square dancing. And so because she is the awesome human that she yeah. is, she was like, it's up to you. You decide. And she was like, and he chose square dancing. And that to me sums up why Will is the most amazing. Because he's like, what? Why would I go to do these math games yeah. when I could be square dancing, man? So I always try to think about that.
Yeah.
Like, we spend a lot of time in our lives.
The key to Will.
Not doing the fun.
Yeah, we do. I can't identify it all the time.
No, it's really hard.
You know, I'm now that I'm old and I've saved some money, I'm sort of like, well, now I'm just going to.
Yeah.
What?
Air fry. You're going to use your air fryer.
I like to cook. Like, yeah. I do, because I have an eating disorder, so I like to spend the entire day cooking like I run a restaurant, just just things that I can eat all week without feeling bad about them.
I like that.
Yeah. It's a,
that's healthy. You have a good, mindful relationship with food.
I do not. I do not.
But cooking is very mindful.
Right, but I just need things like, what if I just need to compulsively stuff my face?
Oh, I see. So you're like, how many Brussels can I eat without vomiting?
Something like that. I'm very into this red cabbage slaw right now.
Yum.
Yeah.
Last night, I took an active, huge bite of my second dinner.
Yeah.
Because I'd flown on the plane and had dinner. And then I had another dinner after I landed, because it landed. You gotta eat something.
I wasn't
hungry at all. Charlie, my husband, was meeting us at our hotel.
You're eating the second dinner not hungry.
Not at all. Not remotely hungry. And he brought Shake Shack, so it's already like not a healthy second dinner.
No.
And I turned to my husband and my son, and I was like, I just took a bite, and I had the unconscious thought, I feel so sick, I hope I can get this down. So why am I still eating? Like, it was so, like, I actually had the thought, like, oh, my stomach feels distended and uncomfortable against my pants.
But I gotta get this down.
But if I do this right, I can get the rest of this burger in. So,
yeah.
It starts by identifying.
I did that the other day. I was in, you know, and it was the second night from, I'm flying back from New York, and I was in the first class. You know, the flagship Admiral's Club. And but I could
eat
in the
restaurant. Dinner. They gave you the dinner before. Right. I've only done it once, but boy, did I tuck in.
Yeah. So I ate that whole fucking dinner, and then I got on the plane.
And they had a dinner. But do you do coffee? What are your other things?
Yeah, a lot of coffee.
Do you drink?
No.
Don't drink?
Sober a long time.
So you got to find other things. What's it put in the mouth? But coffee.
Coffee, so much, to the point where I tip over into a paralysis. Like, I'll drink so much coffee where I go into
a
mild seizure where I'm exhausted.
What about the mushroom coffee?
No.
I switched to that and it made a difference.
Really?
After three.
Yeah. I do
tea. You want to know why?
I'll do a little tea.
Because, so when I was shooting American Auto last summer, I
watched it. I was mentioned on one of the shows. Someone was
listening.
You
were. They're like, Maron's on a rant.
Yeah.
Barinholtz said it.
Yeah.
And he pulled his AirPod out.
Yeah.
It was really funny.
I thought that was nice. Good reference for those of us.
Yeah.
Who know.
In the cast world.
This is a mushroom tea?
So.
It's supposed to be good for you,
I
right?
made a promise to myself. Okay, so what happened with COVID is, you can't just walk up to the craft services table during COVID. Take a big coffee cup and fill it with Swedish fish.
Yeah, you can't.
You have to ask.
Terrible.
So you would have to say to the guy behind, could I have two Starbucks grande cups of Swedish fish, please? Because I hear we're going long.
Yeah.
So that, I decided I was going to try to address my relationship to sugar on campus at work.
Right.
By just.
The COVID was the window of opportunity.
COVID, I was like, since I have to ask for
the shame.
The double grande.
The shame.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to see if I can get through long shooting days without a sugar hit.
Yeah.
And so I switched to, I asked the catering guy, or the craft services guy, I was like, there's this mushroom coffee. It doesn't taste like mushrooms. It tastes like coffee. It's like adaptogens.
Oh.
And it gives you a little bit of brain happy.
It does?
Yeah. It makes you super alert.
Okay.
Like those lion's mane.
Try it. Okay.
You might like it.
So when you're into SNL, like I, for some reason, when I was looking at all the characters, because you did a lot of funny ones, and I don't know that I've ever...
I hope so.
I never...
SNL, the unfunny ones are not something you want to talk about.
No, but you were big over there. You were not like marginalized. You were like...
I had a good time.
Yeah. For six seasons?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know that I've asked people this. Like when you, and I don't know if it's from improv skill or what, how do you do impressions? Like, do you focus on...
Oh, well, I'm not like an... I mean, again...
But even when you do other people, though, is the idea you have to find the thing?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, look, I mean, if you're going to talk to Daryl Hammond or Jimmy Fallon, those guys are... They're savants.
Right, no, I get
really
mimics.
Special.
Yeah.
They're mimics. They have a thing. I mean, Daryl, especially, like...
Well, there's a price to pay for that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But when you would write with him...
With Daryl?
One would write with him.
Yeah.
I would hear him use syntax and vocabulary I had never heard him use conversationally as another character.
Yeah.
He channeled like a whole other person.
Right.
Literally.
Yeah.
It's a really wild skill. And Jimmy, too. Jimmy has an ear for like, and so does Steve Higgins. I mean, there's a few people I know, but from that world. I mean, the rest of us, I would say, the Groundling style people, Molly Shannon, me, I mean, I don't want to speak for everybody, but Will, I feel like we would find our way into the, what the character was or the bit. And you know, like, I only did impressions in the 11th hour from my audition because I heard that I had to have impressions and the people write to them.
Yeah.
So a lot of it just comes down to like, who do you look like?
Yeah.
And what are the things? This is like the most erudite asshole thing that I did. But for my impressions, I did, I did Martha Stewart because I found her really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I still do. I kind of worship her.
Yeah. Have you met her?
Oh yeah. Many times.
Yeah.
But she's, I mean, I wouldn't say we've like had cocktails together, but I would love to.
There's certain people like her that are so like, you know, do so much stuff and are so influential and have all these, you know, odd talents, but they're you sense there's something in there that's sort of like a little off and a little scary.
You would have to be, you're talking about void filling, like people who, I don't know if you feel this way, but like, so I hit, you know, I got SNL, did my 6 years, and then there really is this moment where you're like, the people who then move on to the next stratospheric level in their careers, you're like, wow, you're hungry. Because I am tired.
Yeah.
Like, this is good. Like,
I know.
Some people recognize me. Sometimes I get a good table at a restaurant.
Yeah. No, I get it.
You know?
I get it. I'm not that ambitious, but I clearly need to be busy.
Yeah.
But you've got a family and you've got kids and you have things you like to do, right?
I also have a bifurcated career. So I actually have been really busy. Just
no,
in
I know,
all
I
of these
see that.
No, I'm not saying that defensively, but what I mean is that people from TV maybe will say like, "Where have you been?" And you're like, "Well, I did 5 Broadway shows and I wrote 2 albums and I toured with the band." So I'm always sort of like doing something, but they're like 5 mountains that I'm trying to climb concurrently.
But what are you
know?
Judging against though when you say someone leaves SNL and moves on to like movie stardom?
Well, I just think when I left SNL in particular in the 90s, it was just like, explosive, you know,
careers. Yeah.
Like movie star. The standard bearer was like Sandler.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
At that time.
Were you on with him?
No, right after him.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, the guy would have, like, for years, he did 3 $20 million movies a year.
Yeah.
You know, huge movies that everyone would see in a movie theater.
Yeah.
Whether or not you like them. So, I mean, the idea.
You had to go. It wasn't a matter of like.
I mean, by the way, I don't even know if it's like, who knows what his drive mentality was. I just like.
I don't know either, but I ask myself that all the time, too, because I'm working at whatever my bifurcated career is. I do when I have opportunities.
Stand-up
and some acting and podcasting. And, you know, but I am in a position to not have to do things.
Right.
And I'm just one of those people that's sort of like, well, that's great. You know, like, I don't have to do it, but there are certain things I want to do. But I still always wonder about people that keep doing it when they're not doing anything new with it. It's like, why do you just keep doing it?
Yeah.
I mean, there's very specific people in my head, and there's a certain amount of resentment behind it. So I
can't
I'm
wait
not
to hear you talking about when we sit on the porch. You tell me.
No, it's just
when we have porch time.
Okay, all right. But you know what I mean? Yeah, just sort of like you're just sort of like taking up space. How much money do you need?
I know.
You know?
I do know. Especially when you get into lifestyle branding.
Oh, yeah, I don't know what that's about.
I mean, I would very much love to see a Marc Maron line at Walmart. I'm not going to lie.
I wish I could do that, but like, what? I'm not going to invent anything. I'm not going to hire a team to create. What am I going to create?
But they don't invent anything either. That's what's sort of amazing. The number of people out there that are like, oh, my jewelry line and my makeup line and my thingamajig line and my da-da-da-da line and my you know, hair product. And my, there's nothing new. They're not reinventing the wheel.
They just put their name on it.
Yeah.
What the hell could I put my name on?
Well, let's start with cooking utensils.
Really?
Maron at home.
Okay. Maybe there's a few. How to use the same spoon for everything.
We could do that. We could do a multi-purpose, and then we do a fun little video on TikTok with you all.
I didn't have done TikTok.
15 seconds.
Have you done it?
I have people trying to help me to do it, but yes, I'm on
TikTok.
Are we
supposed to do it? Is there a point where you're like, I'm a grown-up, and I don't want to
do any of it anymore, but my numbers are still so fucking in the middle that I want to be on.
But what are you TikToking for? The American car auto show?
American cars. Oh.
American Auto. That's another old
Cars
guy
Tonight.
Thing.
Cars Tonight. American Auto. The honestly, it comes really more from my own. Well, no, that's not true. I mean, because I wrote a movie with Dratch this year and produced it. So I think anytime that you make something that you...
You're doing something. I think what I was reacting to is that you were clearly judging yourself against these super hyper ambitious people that have humongous profiles. But people like us, we chip away. We're busy. We do things.
Totally.
We get, you know, we have audiences.
Yeah.
You know, we enjoy you know, all different things.
Yeah.
But we do not get appreciated at the same level of those people.
Well,
I'm sorry.
I'm going to do a lifestyle brand.
Okay.
What should my thing be?
Something maybe musical. Maybe you should do a
line of harmonicas?
No, a children's musical instruments.
That's not
xylophones.
Bad. It's funny because in my show, my sidekick, bandleader, plays a glockenspiel that I bought him on Amazon.
Right. That kind of stuff.
It's Amazon's choice.
I think kids' stuff is good. You like that stuff?
I do, actually.
I can give
I've
you
never
one.
Seen that. Are you sponsored by Bronner's?
Not at all, but we have a relationship with Bronner's, and we help them with a book pitch, and they sent me, I have like literally 100 bottles of that.
I do, I love that peppermint.
I think I have a lavender one too.
That's a pick-me-up right there.
Yeah, sure, peppermint's good for a minute. I mean, it's not going to carry
until you
through.
Sag again.
So, all right, so your relationship with Lauren was always good?
Yeah, I would say
you're like one of the, you had fun, and you have nothing but warm memories.
I don't have, like, it was very professional. Is what I would say.
And you were professional, so it was fine. You didn't go there looking for parenting. You went there to do the thing.
I was there at a time when women, when I first came to Saturday Night Live, women were so, it was so presumed that you were going to crash and burn and be destroyed and chewed up and eaten up by the show.
Yeah.
That I had nothing, nowhere to go but hope. So, you know, I got there and my first season was Sherry O'Terry, me, and Molly Shannon. And the three writers were Lori Nasso, Cindy Caponera, and Paula Pell.
Cindy.
And that was it. And we were so overrun by brohams.
Yeah. The way people talk about it, it almost seems like it is a conscious competition that those dudes are out to crush.
It's a very aggro, like hetero. I mean, it's changed a little, but it's a very hetero sportsy kind of mentality.
Yeah.
You know? Totally. I mean, and you know, he's from a school of thought that's like the art of war and
who? Lauren?
Lauren. I mean, it's an older management style that was very popular at the time you started the show. Like out of competition breeds excellence.
Yeah.
And he's not totally wrong.
Right.
But like I had people come up to me. I remember a comedian came up to me on the street when I got cast and was like, "I'm so sorry you got cast. You're so good." Like the assumption.
Right, yeah.
So I would not have, my point is.
A lot of women have crashed and burned on there.
That was the assumption.
Despite their amazing talent.
I was right after like Janine Garofalo and Keitlinger and like really talented women had come through. I know there were like chapters at the very beginning and obviously Nora Dunn and Jan Hooks were incredible. Yeah. But mostly women were sort of not the star, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I was like, well, I'm going to try this, and I was a good student, and I'm not, I don't know, that's what I mean by I wasn't going to be a problem for Lauren.
Right.
Like,
yeah,
I wasn't that, I'm not that rebellious.
Yeah, but you were funny, too, so that was good. That counts for something.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
I mean, I wrote a lot, I had a lot of support from early on writing.
Yeah.
I wrote with amazing people.
Yeah.
I wrote with, you know, McKay and when Tina came, I wrote with Tina and I wrote with Stephen Craig. I wrote with Paula Pell all the time. All the girls did. She's a fucking genius. So there's good people there,
sure,
you know, and you collaborate and you find carve your path, you know.
Now, did you find that when you got out, that was there like a time of like depression or like you, like
the one thing I wish that I, the sadness, no, because I was the first person to have a baby.
Right.
That was the other thing. So I had a baby and I left to have my baby.
Yeah.
And the little bit there had been like a gauntlet thrown now. Like, let's see how this goes if you have a baby and come to work. And Lauren was very nice about it. He was like, we'll write for you.
Yeah.
You don't have to write. But I also knew that the nature of the show was not to do that. Like, I was like, I felt good about my work when I left. I felt like I left with plenty of good work in the bank.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like diminishing returns, which can happen, I think.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what to expect out of parenting. And so I was just like, I just didn't want to try to prove that I could do the show and be a mom at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is fine. Now I wish, though, that I had hung around because a really kind of incredible season for women happened then. You know, I mean, I don't mean season like
the
television season. I mean spiritual season was coming in because Amy Poehler's first year was my last year. So then it turned into this, like, Amy was there, Maya was there, Tina was there, yeah. Rachel was there, Kristen Wiig came in. It was just like a cool,
yeah.
Again, representation matters. So there was like at a point of like six or seven women, it was a lot, you know, compared to the three little paltry chickens in the corner.
Yeah.
So in retrospect, I wish that might have been nice to be a part of. But also I have to say, psychologically, back to Will Ferrell and square dancing, that's my one regret, is I don't think I learned how to have fun there.
Yeah.
I was so afraid of not failing.
Right.
That's why I did theater, actually.
Yeah.
Because my thing was, the best you do at SNL, because it's kind of rough if your brain works around failure at all.
Yeah.
The creative part's amazing.
Yeah.
But the best you could do on Saturday was to not totally fail.
Yeah.
Like, to pull it off.
Right, right.
If you pulled it off.
Well, there's, like, because of the converging on the liveness.
All of it. And it's last minute and singing, whatever. Yeah. And so theater was kind of like a, what's the word I'm looking for?
A savior?
Salvation.
A salve. A salve. Because you could do the show and you could do it again.
It's for OCD, like, it was just, but then that goes too far that way. So it gets very, like, I can do this, I can fix it, I can do this, I can fix it, I can do this, I can fix it. And then after like years of that, like I started to go insane because it was so regimented.
Yeah, yeah.
So then I really was like, I had my son and then I was just sort of desperate to get back to half hour television, which I actually think is the happy medium.
Yeah.
Because you are living inside one character who you get to know and you understand their nuances.
And there's new stuff.
And it's fast.
Yeah.
It's not like turgidly slow with a long fucking process that for comedians is painful.
Yeah.
Because Charlie, my husband, will always make fun of me because I love theater and I love theater people.
Yeah.
But there is this like, it's earnest.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Rehearsal is
And it's
long,
a community, you know, and it's like, yeah.
It's long, long. And I would come, every time I've started a play, I've come home and I'd be like, oh, everybody hates me. And Charlie's like, what do you mean? Are they laughing at your jokes?
Yeah.
And I'll say, no, they're not. He's like, right, because they're doing their job and you're doing bits while you're doing your job. And he's right. Like, comedians are always doing two things at the same time.
But that's the fun. That's the fun.
I know. So half hour television is a nice place in between. And writing and making stuff.
And the music's a nice way to blow off steam and release that you have so much control over. It's great. If you can sing, it feels great.
Yeah, it's fun.
But this new show, American Auto.
American Auto.
It's sort of a nice approach to that odd fish out of water corporate person. Like, it's like it there's something very funny about that character.
Oh, thanks.
And also the setup of it. To be actually to have that much power and just to be thrown on to a major corporation.
Well, and
funny.
Don't you know people? Thank you for saying that. I mean, I think, and also it is, it comes from, there really is a school of management that's like, my job isn't to know how to make cars, it's how to sell cars. You know, like that's where her attitude is. She's from Big Pharma, she's got big swagger.
But it's so funny because it's like, you know, in any other discussion about that person, it'd be a villain. Just a horrible fucking... So like the fact that you've got to bring, you know, charm and humor and kind of this kind of goofiness to someone who's like, I was at Big Pharma and, you know,
I guess.
Well, yeah, it's kind of an interesting take on something we usually associate with just horrible people.
That's really interesting. No one said that yet.
Oh, really?
Well, it's funny because I think I'm thinking about workplace comedies. I'm thinking about like Michael Scott and I'm thinking about how he's a terrible person. Michael Scott's a terrible, terrible person.
Yeah.
But again, because it's Carell and because it's... Dudes, I don't know. Like, I feel like guys have been afforded that a lot. But
even the original Office, when you watched Gervais do whatever the fuck that was that he was doing.
Yeah.
Like.
Horrible.
What is it? Yeah, I know. But it's beyond cringe into this other zone.
I know. So likable. Because you find yourself.
You feel bad for him.
You feel bad for him.
That one episode where he does that dance.
Yeah.
It's over.
And not knowing all the. I think Justin Spitzer, who writes American Auto, the creator, I think he does this really well, writing situations wherein people are like fumfering and bullshitting what they don't know.
Yeah,
and it's so common in the workplace
because you can talk in the jargon. There's people that just do that talk.
I can't even tell you how many.
It's unbelievable.
Because Rachel and I wrote a movie, and so I had to do a lot more sort of, as a producer, grown-up stuff where I would talk
Which
to actual...
Movie?
We wrote this Christmas movie called A Clusterfunk Christmas that we did last year.
Yeah.
It was a parody of those Hallmark, cheesy Hallmark movies.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
Super fun. But
a lot of sweaters?
A lot of sweaters. A lot of Henleys, too. A lot of men's Henleys. Anyway, it was amazing. We would get letters from, like, or emails about things that would be 100% jargon... where I would not understand. I would have to like decipher it, like a more like a code.
All they're doing is they're sending out dispatches to displace blame if the shit hits the fan.
Absolutely,
that's
right.
That's the entire equation of that bullshit.
Absolutely,
I said,
right.
We sent them an email, kind of discussing that.
Yeah, totally.
It's not on us.
We covered it.
Yeah, we sent them an incomprehensible bunch of bullshit.
We're gonna circle back and we'll touch base around that later.
Yeah,
we're not gonna kick this down the road. We're in the paint with you. What?
Yeah.
Insane.
It is.
Anyway.
But you like doing it.
I like ensemble stuff. Yeah, I like working with other people. I like the energy of lots of... It's funny, too, because this show and the show I did right before this had...
Which one was that?
It was a show called People of Earth. Was about abduction survivors. It was a support group. So we had these like epic scenes with all 10 of us. I ran the support group.
Yeah.
And it was like in both situations, the showrunner's like, I know these days are really long in the conference room. I'm always like, but that's all like, to me, that's my favorite part.
Yeah.
Because we do bits.
Yeah.
We fuck around. You get to know the, and you don't have that like all day with one other actor going to the chairs.
Yeah.
It's like 10 other, but no one ever fights.
Right. It's nice.
Yeah. I like
the energy.
You feel
like you're part of a group. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad you're happy and working, and you still seem to be in touch with and friends with a lot of the people from the old days.
Yes.
That's nice.
I try to be.
Well, I know a lot of people you talked to. It really was heartbreaking to me. It took me about 1,000 episodes of the show to realize that people really don't hang out with each other after the movie's over. And then when I did some acting, you don't talk to those people, really.
I feel like you really get one a show, maybe.
Yeah,
but
who you're really friends with.
Yeah, I would say one. SNL's different. And it is.
Well, you feel like you've been through something traumatic together.
There's trauma bonding for sure.
Yeah.
There's also just like mutant bonding.
Yeah.
And to his immense sort of probably accidental credit, I mean, Lorne is very loyal, and he's stayed at the same place all this time, so he considers everybody who comes through this like he has this tribal, and for years you can rail against it in therapy, whatever. You're in the fucking mafia. You're not allowed out. So
right. Yeah.
So once you kind of surrender to that idea, it's actually kind of great. Because the resources are extraordinary. Like it's literally one of those therapy things. Like,
what you mean you can go eat over at 30 Rock and stuff?
No, meaning like, I mean, it took me a long time. I guess I should just speak for myself. Yeah. I don't know what anyone else feels there because everybody's so unique. But realizing, I went through my phase of I don't want anything to do with the show. I don't want to talk about the show. I don't want to. Why do people always want to talk about the show? Yeah. Why do they always want to interview about the show? Yeah. And then eventually being like, oh, well, but if I need help, I don't know, directing my first music video. Oh, I'm going to call Yorma Taconi. He'll do it. And we'll do it. We'll do an amazing music video that we know organically. The skill set is so fast and so I got my neighbor's baby. We use my neighbor's baby. Speed with which we get it done.
Yeah.
And the sort of elation of making something quickly, ridiculous and fun. And definitely writing the movie with Rachel, the immediacy with which you're the sensibility, the shorthand.
Did you know Hal Wilner?
Oh, very well.
That's
yeah.
So sad.
Oh, horrible. Yeah.
Like everybody, I didn't know him, but he seemed like an amazing music person.
He was just an amazing everything person. Just like and all those people who walk through that space in this own sense.
Yeah.
Also, it's just full of, frankly, anomalous, truly anomalous weirdos.
Yeah.
That Lauren's given a home.
Yeah.
And made space for.
Yeah.
And
well, that's nice. Nice way
and,
to look
and
at
their
it.
Skill set is utterly anachronistic. Like there's no point. If you go to SNL, you see a lot of the cameramen.
Yeah.
They come from live TV. There's pictures of them with old Norelco cameras. They all shoot the Macy's parade and the Super Bowl.
I interviewed Lorne, and really, at the end of the day, he's a guy that produces a television show, and he works. That's his job. And that's how he sees himself.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm here. This is my building. This is my office.
Yeah.
And I've worked here for a million years.
Yeah.
Outside of being a billionaire and a genius, he sees himself on a practical level as a utilitarian kind of. I'm a TV producer.
Yeah, he's a very that show has grounded his life too. Mm-hmm. His routine and all that. He's a very routined person.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's wandering those halls forever, and it made me look at him totally differently. I used to think he's like this all powerful thing. It's like no, he's just this guy.
Yeah.
That's wandering these halls for 40, 50 years, however long it's been.
Almost 50.
It's amazing. But I get it. So like once you're in, you can have, you have relationships with all these different people.
Yeah, it's just the amazing, yeah. I mean, not that you're friends with everybody, but there is, I actually, the first time I met Sandler, I had just left the show and we sat down. I don't even know him that well. I know yeah. I'm surprised it came up twice in one conversation, but we were at the opening of some Broadway show
yeah.
and he sat down like down the row and yeah. we just looked at each other and he was like, I know. Like it just, you have this instant with anyone there, Bobby Moynihan, like
right.
I think I embraced him on the street, you know,
yeah.
the Kate McKinnon turned around the first time I ever met her also in a theater and she turned around to me. She was like, do you ever not know what to write? Like, do you ever not? So the immediacy of all of that,
yeah, yeah,
not
yeah.
that you like stay yeah, great yeah, friends yeah. with them. I happen right. to be very close to a bunch of my female cohorts because there was an active recognition at a certain point that we were so, our experience was so insanely unique.
Yeah.
Especially the women who followed me that we share kind of almost a support group. But
sure. Who's in that group?
That's a lot of the Betty White gang. That's Rachel and Poehler and
yeah,
Tina
right,
and
right,
Paula
yeah,
and
yeah.
Emily Spivey and the Wine Country Girls. And,
yeah.
And that kind of just emerged out of like, again, because of all, Lauren would have all of these reunions and sort of the shared like Amaya too.
It's nice.
Yeah.
It's like this, it's almost like a school.
That's exactly what it's like.
Yeah.
Or an army troop. Or,
yeah.
Yeah. People have those. Yeah.
I don't know that I've really quite heard it put that way, but I like it. All right. So what are you going to do now? Where do you go?
What, after American Auto or life?
Life. What are you going to, you're in LA for what? You're going to the Super Bowl?
We're going to the Super Bowl.
For NBC?
Yes, my overlords invited us.
Are they?
It's awesome. The swag is making me laugh so hard.
Really? Do you like football?
Not really. Yeah. I love all, I do have like an enthusiasm for like the Super Bowl of each thing in life. And
yeah.
I feel like Charlie and my husband and I have been lucky to get to do like, because of the Three Penny Opera, like I presented at the Tonys and,
yeah, yeah.
you know, I feel like we got to go to the SNL
right,
40th
right.
and
yeah.
we've been to, he's in advertising. We go to, Cannes has this advertising explosion like every year that's
oh,
like,
you go to Cannes?
We've gone to Cannes for the, you know, Montreal
yeah.
Comedy Festival.
Yeah.
Like I love these things that are like the creme de la
sure,
creme
sure.
of the thing.
And you can just be there and eat some stuff.
And they're all the same. They have yeah. like the hospitality suite,
yeah.
a bunch of parties
yeah.
And the specific crowd that does it every year fascinates me. So it was so funny arriving NBC, like they invited us out and we're being arranged for through all of the other like advertisers
yeah.
and stuff that are going.
Yeah.
Because I think most people are in LA already. Anyway, so they happened to bestow upon us the swag bag for
yeah.
the advertisers.
Oh.
And it's like these douchey wraparound glasses,
yeah.
like the, you know, like a... a backpack cooler, a Yeti cooler. Charlie was like, this is, I mean, it just makes me laugh because each thing is its own little world. That's
yeah.
We saw a bunch of guys in the hospitality suite with their Yeti backpack coolers,
oh, yeah.
like heading out to golf. I'm like, I don't understand what's happening.
It's another world.
I
man.
Love it. So I wish I could show you randomly.
What?
So it's one of the things I love about American Auto. I have my NBC Universal ID.
Yeah.
And there was a mix up
yeah.
and they ended up using one of my like corporate pictures that were the stills from my office
yeah,
as
yeah.
my character.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like this insane corporate portrait of my character on my real ID. So I look like Joanne from, you know, human resources.
Great.
Yeah.
I'll give you some swag. I'll give you the...
Oh, yeah. What's my swag? What's the Marin swag?
Swag. It's a hand-thrown mug by a guy named Brian Jones.
Really?
That all the guests get.
That's beautiful.
Yeah,
I didn't realize the ceramic arts were such a piece of your story.
Yeah, there's little pictures of the cats, the original crew of cats, and my face. And I'll show you.
Okay.
And I'll tell you who I was thinking
What's your
about.
Relationship to Brian Jones?
He was a fan, and he offered, you know, to make mugs. And originally, it was just for guests. And occasionally, he'll do a run of them for sale, and they disappear within seconds.
I'm sure.
But it was he just was wanted to be do something with the show.
That's really cool.
So he created it.
I love it.
All right. Well, have fun.
Get out.
No, it's nice talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Anna Gasteyer. Yes. Great talk, right? The show American Auto is on NBC. Look for it on your NBC affiliate. Do you still say that? Look for it on your thing. Stream it. Do whatever you got to do. All right? It's on Tuesday nights. It's also streaming on Peacock. Now I'm going to do a long guitar thing. I kind of got into it.
It's crunchy. Boomer lives. Monkey and La Fonda. Cat angels everywhere.